As we think about struggling students, there's a lot of different things that can constitute what struggling means. What is it? Is it all about? All about. I'm kind of interesting just to know the class a little bit here. How many of you will be teaching for the first time this year? Okay, so we have some experienced teachers in here. How many of you have taught for 3 or more years? Okay. So you come with some experience in dealing with struggling students. Because they're everywhere. Students that we classify as strugglers. And there's a reason for that classification. Most of the time it's because of their ability to keep up with everyone else. So we use a measurement of some type. That measurement is academics. But in some cases, it is the very thing that they struggle with the most that we measure them with. So the measurement isn't quite true often. But I will be speaking off of the handout that you have there. We're going to be looking at some things here. I want this to be an interactive class. If you, as we're discussing, going through discussion here, if you have something you want to put in there or you have an idea or something to share, you know, just catch my attention. If waving doesn't do it, look for something to throw at me. The motion will catch my eye. But if you hit me, I guarantee you to get results. But let's get into looking at us as teachers and these children that we class as strugglers. The first thing you're going to see there, the first couple things on that handout talk to us as teachers. We must have a patient, loving, understanding spirit. Many of these children do not understand themselves, and they live with fears and misconceptions about themselves and their struggles. Strive to understand their unique ways of processing. Above all, accept them for the individual that God has created them to be, and help them to accept themselves. This fear of the unknown, of why I can't perform like the other students can. And we might think in ourselves that we're the teacher and we detect this thing. And they're just not on clue with what's going on. If they were, they'd turn the steam up. But don't fool yourself there. Most of them are very aware of what's going on. They realize that they aren't getting done what the others need are getting done. They compare themselves. We do that a lot. We do that among ourselves. We do that with others. This game of comparison. Because we feel like we have something to hold on to when we have statistics, measurements. And that's what we're all after, is something that tells us where we are. But suppose there is no answer to that one that we can get. We have to kind of accept things like they are. That's a little bit frightening and challenging. But to help them understand themselves, maybe we don't understand them, but if we are compassionate towards them, it feels so good to know that someone cares, that I'm not in this by myself, different from these other students. You know, if you take a walk in the woods, you have a little child or a younger person there, there's something about having someone beside you. There's something about knowing that someone is going to walk with you. And there's really something about someone that's willing to take your hand or to put their hand on your shoulder and to say, I'm here for you. We're going to do this. The woods aren't so scary. Things, I can take time to look at other things and maybe explore thoughts instead of being just consumed with this fear about myself. And I speak a lot from experience. As a child and a student, when we face a classroom like this, we're going to have to be prepared with all the variety that God gives us. As I spoke of yesterday, there's going to be those that don't operate as fast. Sometimes we have discussions with individuals that will talk about their slow student. They're slow. They just don't get their work done. They don't. On the playground, they're the last one to get out to the game. There is such a thing as just being slow. You know, like some people have blonde hair. Hey, it's their genetic makeup. I had a little fellow one time that never got anywhere on time. I mean, just going through the school, he was okay with being last. And he even talked real slow. When Donald raised his hand and I called on him, it wasn't going to be, "Mr. Whit." I was wondering, no, it's going to be, "Mr. Whit, I was just wondering." That was Donald. And I didn't need to have to try to figure out how to do that anymore, and I needed to figure out how to change the color of some hair in that classroom. I needed to accept Donald for who he was and the way he was. Encourage him to keep up as much as he can. But he's just Donald. And he still is today. So, we as teachers, we have a big responsibility. We have a room full of responsibilities. And we have a job to get done. And before us, we have a track laid out that we need to cover the ground on within a year's time. And it can feel kind of overwhelming sometimes. Those of you that are experienced know exactly what I'm talking about. And we look at all of the different variations we need to carry along with us down this track. But there are some things that we need to be conscious of and think about in dealing with individuals. Now, I'm not going to be, of course, the work that I do is mostly with dyslexic children, because of the fact that 1 out of 5 people in this world over are dyslexic. 85% of all learning struggles are represented as dyslexia. So, it is the most common learning struggle out there. It is always genetically passed on. It's everywhere. It has been. We can track it back through centuries of longer ago, and a couple of hundred years ago, up until the 1900s, it was called word blindness. People, children, that just don't read and spell very well and are kind of slow, and it's hard for them to get things done that deal with words. So, it's been around. People have asked us, you know, sometimes in meetings where I'm speaking, they just wonder, why are we hearing so much about this? Why is it coming up so much more? Is there more of it than there used to be? And then we start looking at the way we eat and the nutrition and all that's going on. Hey, it's just as, I don't know whether it was Adam or Eve. I don't know. God does. It's always genetic, and it's going to be present as it passes on. That's the way it works. And there's just as much of it as it ever was, but there's more people in the world than there ever were. So do the math, 1 out of 5. That's what statistics, and those are cold hard statistics, tell us about learning struggles and dyslexia. But what can we do in the classroom about these things to deal with them as teachers? We must be prepared to spend more time when teaching things that require phonetic processing and writing, or anything that requires these individuals to put their thoughts down on paper. Because that is the catch. When we read something, and this is what confuses some people, they say, well, when this child reads, they read fairly well. But when we read something, the words, half the work is done. The words are already put together. The phonetics is done. It's down on paper already. And it's in a play, in a form that it completes thoughts. A lot of the work is done. But when we have to do that as individuals, or they have to, and they have to write things down, we have to process the thought that we're thinking. And then the words and the letters that build those words and the sounds that go with those letters to represent the word. And then those words have to be put down in an order to express our thoughts. That whole process is difficult. It goes beyond just writing it. For some people, and I would be one of those, I have to think about what I want to say. I think about something because of putting the words together to convey the thought. I don't have a very big vocabulary. We expand our vocabularies through reading. You read and you learn and you think and you store those thoughts away, and these, oh, that's what these words mean. And, you know, unconsciously, basically, we are expanding our vocabulary quite a bit the more we read. So, in the same hand, the less we read, the smaller and the more basic our vocabulary is. So if you have a child that expresses themselves in very basic language, they're thinking of words that mean what they want to say and convey the thought, and then they're putting those in order. It's a process. It's a real process. I have sat in meetings with other educators before. The Lord called me into the realm of education. He knew more than I did and still does and always will. But it was a challenge. I'd be sitting in roundtable conferences with educators. You know, educators have a very... they have big vocabularies. Some of them say that at all times I'm reading three different books. I just find that not only interesting, mind-boggling and phenomenal. But they, in our discussions, I'm keeping up with what the discussion and the thought pattern and the train, you know, I'm on the train somewhere, and they're flipping these $9.50 words out on the table, and I'm constantly trying to think about, okay, now, what we just said, and he said that, what does that mean? You know, because I'm going to add that to my vocabulary. I'm going to try. But that's a way of life. That is a way of life. It's no fun just to survive. We learn to, because survival is a natural instinct. I'm a licensed electrician, and just not long ago, I had to go to the courthouse there where we live and take care of some formalities and forms and getting some permitting done. And we that struggle with this type of processing, we learn to live on the guard. Not just to, write things down and show them to other people. So the first thing this lady does is she hands me a form. Forms scare me to death because they have blanks that need to be filled. Now, if there's just checks and yes and no, I'm good to go. But she hands me a form. And just soon into that form, There was something there that I did not know how to spell. I knew exactly what it was, but I did not know how to spell it. And I did not want this lady to know that I am a licensed electrician and I can't spell. So we survive. This lady's desk looked like, oh, this looks really nice here. This lady's desk hadn't seen daylight in a long time. And it had a variety of things all over it. Although they were all pointed in her direction, I'm pretty good at reading upside down. I took off. My eyes were just up. Oh, there's the word right there. I wrote it in. She never knew I didn't know how to spell the word. Yeah, it's survival, but it's no fun. It would be nice to be able to just phonetically know how words go together. And we can do things, and we'll talk about in another workshop, Lord willing, we'll talk about some of those things that will do that for us. But what can we do to make accommodations for children like that? Letting them express themselves orally, ask them questions, and accept some of those even in graded situations. There's a lot of accommodations that we can make. And one of the things that we've got to, in accepting the child, we've got to realize that as we make accommodations, we're not trying to make school easy. That is not our goal. We want them to climb the ladder. We want them to meet challenges. But we don't want them to drown and end up hiding under the ladder because of the way they feel about themselves. We are individuals. Every one of us that are in here have our own thought patterns and see life and school and teaching. And hopefully you're inspired with imparting knowledge. To me, it is the desire to know, to learn, and to see children that want to do that. You know, children naturally want to learn. Sometimes we don't feel like that. Sometimes we think that's a mystery to me. But that is the real bottom line. Children want to know. They want to be propelled into the unknown by some means. And we as teachers take them there. But we all have our own learning styles ourselves. And that's the one we know best. So we have a tendency to use that as our toolbox to draw from to teach them. That's experience teaches us that. And as we learn, as we teach, as we work, we learn to work with children in their individual way of learning. But there's some things that we can do by stepping outside the box of our own learning style. There are things that we can do that will help meet the needs of a variety of learning styles. One thing that I encourage you not to do is to become bound up in your curriculum, whatever your curriculum is. Now, I don't want you to go back to school this year with your hatchet ready and sharp, and you're going to chop this curriculum all to pieces, and we're going to pick out what we are going to do and what we're not going to do. And the man at WFTI told me we could do this. I want you to think about this. What is curriculum for? What is our job? What's our bottom line? Like I said, I'm an electrician. When I walk into a setting, a house, there's issues here. We don't just start working on the first thing that we lay eyes on. You know, we've got the stove torn halfway apart when the lady taps us and says, "You came to fix the water heater." You know, no. We want to be specific. We want to zero in on what's going on here and thinking about what we're going to do. And there's ways that these children learn, and they learn. We need to understand what makes them tick. What is their avenue of learning? It may be different. Hey, in studying children that learn differently, I'm going to tell you, there's some out there, we specialize in dyslexia, but there's some out there with issues like ADD, ADHD, and, well, we could go on into some others, but they're real. They are very real. Children that cannot hold still, that's the way their brain works. Their motor nerves are tied to their processing pathways. And shuffling their feet, moving something around, moving things on their desk, rubbing things, annoying things to a teacher. You can work with that to a certain degree. But it may be a certain fact that you're going to have to also accept some of that as who that person is. Now, if they're doing that and looking around at who all I'm getting, that's a different story. That's something that needs to be dealt with disciplinary. But if they aren't even thinking of it, I know of situations where students have already had to stand beside their desk to work. Every few minutes they had to get, and they could work just as well if they were getting rid of this energy. I have screened children. We do screening for dyslexia. We have screened children that had ADHD. And how did we know they had ADHD? Because they were actually laid on top of the table we were screening, sitting, it's supposed to be sitting at, and rubbing the tabletop like this. They're supposed to be on that side of the table, and we're on this side of the table, but they're laid across the table, and we're almost nose to nose, and she's still answering questions. We're doing great. We're going through the screen. This is what it takes. Now, we think that is totally impractical. And it's not really realistic to have them on top of their desk, you know. But there are things we can do to help them with that. Have any of you ever heard of a wiggle seat? Those wiggle seats work. We try to tell schools and teachers about those for students that have this need to feel motion. It's simply a little air-filled cushion, plastic cushion-like thing that goes on the seat. The ones that I've seen have fingers on one side, little plastic fingers sticking up, and the other side is kind of smooth, and they can sit on those fingers, and you can imagine what that stimulation's like to sit on all those plastic fingers. It gives you the feeling that you're doing a lot of something that you're not. You don't have to move much to feel like you are. It's a great little invention, but it is an accommodation. An accommodation is when we're willing to do things to get the job done. Curriculum. People that get tied up in their curriculum, we can't do that. It's the book says we have to do this. Look, curriculum, and I'm going to say this as a representative of Christian Light Education, curriculum are simply tools to get your job done. Decide what your job is. Curriculum is put together that it already has a design. It has a format. It is all organized and structured. It gives us a way to motivate through this block of knowledge with a route that is proven, set, and will take us where we want to go. But don't let it turn into the thing that actually decides how your classroom is going to operate. Be willing to step outside and use your curriculum in a way that is most suited for you. I've had children that I worked with that I changed points. That the curriculum, the work said so many points for each thing. I changed that because the points I felt like for what they were asking were just too high, or either weren't or not enough. Be careful. Think through what you do. Another thing was fill in the blanks. You know, we're taking a quiz or a test or something, and we're, the information is asking for us to recall knowledge and fill in the blanks. For some children, that is a real struggle to completely make the whole recall from knowledge up here to paper answers. Giving them a word block. That the answers are in that word block, but there are a lot of other words in there that aren't used too. Let them go through that. If there's a knowledge of the material, they'll find that answer and they'll know that answer. But what that word block has just done is relieve them of a lot of processing pressures. So, to allow them to have things like that and extra time, especially time, when we're thinking of processing and things going slower, working harder. See, unless you've been there, it's hard really to understand how much energy is put into just making the machinery run besides putting out the product. And it takes time. It takes a lot of energy. A lot of these children that we think they're slow, they're working 10 times harder than the others that can spit them out like a copy machine. They can go through their work. And we as teachers, I learned fairly quickly that I have to have something for those children to do to keep them challenged, accommodations for those students, because they can be the biggest, sharpest thorn in your flesh. It's when they have plenty of time on their hands without anything to do. Think of something. Come up with a structure that is going to be what we do when we're finished with the assignment. Something that they go to. And not just a little bit of it either. I mean, this is what we do. So that they automatically have something to keep them occupied. And it gives you time to work with the others. Now the other student, the one that's moving along slower, that's processing with difficulty, and just doesn't work as fast, that struggling student needs to feel like it's okay to be in their time frame and that you're okay with it. And that they as a class accept themselves. You know, children know each other a lot better than we give them credit for. They know each other. And even you can back down into the younger grades, they know their classmates that struggle. They really do. And they usually feel a little more compassionate towards them. And it feels good when the teacher gives them extra help. They know they're getting something they need. See, if we could take these out of the context of the mind and the hidden material up here between the ears, and put it into practical, like, things we could see, physical handicaps, we don't have any problem accepting accommodations and exceptions and things being done for those people. And we need to get to this point to where we can be the same way with those that struggle up here, with those hidden handicaps. It's not the easiest thing to do, but it's part of finding my way into accommodations for a classroom with a variety of learning styles. There's a teaching, we can easily fall into a teaching rut. It's kind of like fast food. You know, when you go to a fast food restaurant, I can go to a McDonald's in Oregon and expect to get something just like I can get at McDonald's in Georgia. They have set guidelines, and they don't move from those guidelines. And they work back there. If you ever watch them work back there, I like to watch people that are very efficient. I like to see people that study things that happen efficiently. Used to own a bakery, and just icing cakes. My daughter is working in the move the bowl on the other side. That way you don't dip over here for the icing. Put this elbow on the table. Turn the spinner with this hand. Just little things along the way. We like efficiency. But then, my wife and I, because of all the traveling we do, we have to eat in a lot of different restaurants. I don't look for McDonald's. I'm more apt to look for a little restaurant somewhere where I can get something that someone cares about what they're doing. You know, that doesn't make 900 hamburgers a day and one just like the other and could care less who eats any of them. I'm looking for the one that has some character. Something that has got the feeling of individualism in it. And if our classrooms need to be the same way, those individuals need to know we care about them as they are, and we'll prepare for them what they want. You know, realizing that that's important to people, that really made the difference in Burger King years ago. Burger King came out with this slogan that said, "Have it your way." And they would allow you to order with ketchup, with only mayonnaise, no mustard, hold the onions. In that production line back there, they would individualize your hamburger. And you'd get it like you ordered it. That was a huge boost for them, and the others caught on. And you can do that a lot. What is that really saying? That I care about you as an individual? And that's the same thing. Fast food education has turned into what society is doing out there. That's what's going on out there. A lot of it. Especially in the vast volumes of the public school system. They don't have time. They can't slow down like that. And you've got to go through a lot of paperwork just to get them to slow down for an individual child. They're going to cram them right down the same tube using the same curriculum unless somebody cares enough to do something different. So, thinking about some common sense things when we think about accommodations for children that struggle, we think about this list of things here. Minimizing distractions. These are the children that, because of what's in front of them is a struggle. Nobody likes to do things that are hard. If you do, I'd like to talk to you afterwards. You are a unique individual. But we like to do things, and we like to find a easy, efficient way to do them. But we think minimizing those distractions in the room, those are the children that most of the time can tell you the odd things that are going on. Things even in the school, out of your classroom. They notice those things. I can so well remember a little boy that interrupted me during social studies class. Held his hand up and I said, yes, his name was John Wayne. Yes, John Wayne? He said, "We're out of paper towel in the boys' restroom." Okay. Lessen their workloads. And like I said, we're not trying to make school easy for them. We don't want to handicap these children. We want to challenge them to climb the ladder and to learn. But we need to find ways to keep them from just struggling and drowning. There was just lately, my wife and I, we were in contact with a school. They were telling us about this little boy that they keep in because he can't get his work done in a day's time, so he has to stay after school. That's necessary sometimes to get some one-on-one instruction time. But we're talking about to the tune of 5, 6, and 7 o'clock into the evening. Every night that little boy stayed there. And the teachers happened to live in the same building, only upstairs in an apartment. So they would swap off taking turns who's going to stay with the little fellow. But what about the little fellow? Hey, look, what teacher or student isn't hungry after school? Need a break? He saw everybody else leave, but he knew he had hours of work to do yet. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize something needs to be different. Let's back off and look at the picture. Let's make it fit. Let's make it work. And if minimizing his workload or cutting it back or customizing it will help. Because these children that work hard in a day's time in school, they are the ones that don't need homework instead of always have homework. If you put your mind to it, there are ways to do it. And you don't realize, probably as a teacher, what that means to mom and dad. For little Johnny who comes home every night with a stack of homework to come home and say, I don't have hardly anything, or I only have a few minutes, or I only have this to do. That's encouraging to everybody. And you know what? That sets the pace for tomorrow in that classroom for that child. School can turn around. If we need to, be willing to read orally quizzes and tests, things that will be a real stumper for them. We want to know what they know. We don't want to know what their struggles are. They already know that, and we've got a good idea at it, but we need to know what they know. Sometimes working around this doorway of reading, and that's where remediation is really the answer, but when we're needing just to work with it, be willing to do it orally. I had my son. He was trying to take his driver's test to get his driver's license. He's dyslexic. He struggles like I do. We had, in the state of Georgia, we had a written test. And you studied your book and got ready for this test, and they gave you a written test. He studied and he studied and he studied because that's the way life was for him in school. He went to take his test and he failed it. It was a disappointment, but not a total surprise. He studied and studied some more. We went back again to take it. And I also happened to be in charge of all of the state drug and alcohol testing for driver's license in our area. So I kind of knew a little bit about preparedness for driver's license. But he studied and he faced that test again. And he failed it. I felt so sorry for him. I felt so sorry for him. And he felt sorry too. I mean, he felt bad. And he's not a little child anymore. He's 16 years old. And I knew that in another city just up the road is a brand new thing that's just starting up in a new state patrol post. They're giving this same test. It'd have to be the same information on a screen. They're asking the question with a picture of the actual intersection or the signs and things like that, all the stuff that's on that test. I told him, get in the truck, let's go. I didn't know that you're supposed to wait a certain length of time between taking that test, so I was innocent. But we went straight up the road to that city and went in, and he went in there and he aced that test. Now, did he know the material? Absolutely. It was having to recall and put it down on paper and understand what the question wanted. But so far as knowing the material, absolutely. That happens more than we realize. That oral testing. Do away with timers. Timers are great things. Take them home and bake cookies with them. Or use them somewhere to do something that needs to be timed. But where in life are we timed in what we do? I'm convinced that the person that came up with a timer was a teacher that learned, or someone that learned exceptionally and was just looking for one more challenge, so they wanted to know, see how fast I can do it. But the timed issue really complicates someone that's struggling. Often, they think, not only do I have to do this, but I have to do it before that thing that's sitting up there, tick, tick, tick. I've got to get it done. Where in life do we do things like that? Why do we employ those thoughts in education? Find other ways. Be creative. I never used timers because I knew what they were like. So as a teacher for 20-some years, I would just find ways to encourage students to put yourself against it. Let's try to do it as fast as you can, and you know, I just be creative. We don't want to let them get lost and just not care. They need to learn to work with things in a timely way. But even achievement tests, I know those are official scores, but if you will check, those achievement tests can be done without timers. And allowing a child all of the time that they need to think and process their way through something. Avoid classroom exposure. That goes along with the baggage of how I feel about myself and my hiding it from others and what I'm dealing with outside of just being slow. Always, you know, give them the respect of, if their grades aren't good grades, give them the respect of passing out grades or some way that you do it that they feel like it's between you and them. That you respect them, you care about them. You don't expose them. That you're on their side. To help them through this thing. Be careful about impulsive remarks in the classroom. Is that as far as you are? Can you work a little faster? And things like that. They wonder, why is she telling me that? Why didn't she tell him that? That's because he's already a page ahead of me. I'm always behind. But it also tells me that she's not happy with me. She's not satisfied with where I am. And it makes things a little heavier. I found that having some type of a positive relationship with the student, that we have established between the two of us understandings that I realize this is difficult. School is a struggle for you. And with certain things. So I'm going to help you out. I want you to realize that we're working together on this. That if I see you're lost, your distraction, if I walk past your desk and tap on your desk, you know that's our secret signal to get back to work. Work at it. Stick with it. I'm only helping you. I'm going to be with you in this. Get a relationship that lets them know that I'm standing right there with them. And am willing to help them, but most of all, I care about them. And that I want to help them through this. Find ways to help them experience success in the classroom. Some means. We've got to bring this thing to a close, but some of these last ones here have some real strength to them. Discover the way that they can feel good about themselves and experience the level of success It gives them a lot to stand on. Allow them to work in pairs. Some people say, oh, that's not fair. Well, look, if he was missing a leg, what would you do for him? Yeah, I've already let students work in pairs. The one read for both of them. And they work together. What's the bottom line? To impart knowledge. What I need to do to get to the bottom line is what I need to do. Grade their work on content, not spelling. Give them assignments. Let's check. I've seen students get back papers that had X's all over it, had right answers that weren't spelled right. There was something wrong, and some of them, the spelling was bad enough that made you wonder if they really knew what they were trying to write. But if you would ask them the question, they could tell you the answer. Let's look at the content of the subject. Deal with the other issues on the side. And then using word boxes to give them clues and helps in the phonetic processing part. And motivational charts. That's a big one that I would like for us all to think about. Whatever you use for motivation, make it so that every student, and this takes some creativity, that every student can experience it and can add to it and can be a part of it. Never should a child be left behind. When I walk into classrooms and I see the neat little motivational charts on the wall, teachers are very creative people. And it's a little train, you know, with all the cars, and it doesn't take long to pick up what the theme is here. You know, the more of something that they're doing, the more cars are on their trains and all like that. And then you see the one down here, it has two cars on it, or maybe one car on it. My heart goes out to that child. Because he sees that every day. But he knows that everybody else sees it too. That screams at him as to who I am and what I can't do. We think if you'll just work harder, if you'll just work harder, and every once in a while if I bait him and challenge him hard enough, he'll exceed to a certain point. I say, aha, you can do it, you just don't want to. You prove to me you can do it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if I would like to invite you to jump up there and touch where the wall and the ceiling come together and expect you to do it, if you tried hard enough and long enough and devised different ways, you probably could come closer than you think. It might take some speed. I don't know what all it'd take. But can you do it every day? Is that have I baited you to an exceptional challenge? And when you do it, I expect that high mark to be your norm? That's not real. We need to be willing to read the norms of every day. It's okay to challenge. It's okay to motivate. We want to do that. But we've got to do it in the realms of reality. And to where every one of them can contribute. I'll just throw this out quickly. I enjoy motivational things that include the whole class. That they're all, wherever they are, they're contributing into a pot of some kind. And when the pot gets to a certain point, whether it's links on the wall or whatever it is, then we're all going to do something together. So everybody maxing their abilities to contribute to the whole lets us all experience. Things like that build the team spirit that carries classrooms and teachers far into relationships. I've heard students tell each other at the end of the day, hey, study your spelling words tonight. Let's see how many, you know, links we can get, or how more points in the pot, you know, whatever we're doing. That among themselves. And Tommy, who everybody knows, struggles with spelling like everything. Tommy, study tonight now. You can help us out. That's going to go further with Tommy than anything I as a teacher could have said all day long. His peers. They've accepted him, but they're also encouraging him. Motivation is a powerful tool. Okay, I'm going to bring this to a close. We're out of time. I appreciate your attendance here.